Hi, I'm Ken.
And I'm Dee.
And this is Antiques Freaks.
Responsible, safe, socially distant antique time podcast.
What antiques we talk about this week?
We're going to talk about a surprisingly deep rabbit hole that I have only begun to plumb.
Oh?
Antique glass and porcelain insulators.
Oh. Do tell, do tell, do tell.
So when I got the idea in my head, I was just like, you know, there's probably not a lot to say on the subject. Boy, was I ever fucking wrong.
Is that not the story of antiques?
That's antiques every time. Because you get into some things end up being like fairly straightforward. You know, at the end of the day, when you're doing like gemstones, you know, it doesn't actually go very deep.
Except in the mines that go quite deep.
Heyo. But with insulators, I didn't expect as much information as there was. And boy, there's a lot. Which is great news for anyone who wants to get into insulators. But first, I should explain what that is.
Before we get started, would you say that prior to researching this topic, you had been somewhat insulated?
Did you, like, know? Did you, like, hack my webs and find out that I was doing this, and then you came up with some puns?
I've been working on that joke for months.
Yeah, I knew it. Yeah. You had it ready because you're like, I'm gonna have to talk about insulators eventually.
One of these days, one of these fucking days, Dee's gonna bring in insulators, and oh, I'll be ready.
And when that day comes.
How ready I'll be.
Always have notes to insert puns into a friend's conversation.
They love that.
But an insulator is like a glass or porcelain cup that you put on the T-bars of poles, power, telephone, telegraph, to insulate the wires from the wood.
What happens if the wires aren't insulated from the wood?
So this is where...
This is where the science happens?
Yeah, this is where I get hazy on it because it's very sciencey. I actually really hope that, like, someone's really into science getting really mad about this right now.
Sorry in advance, Dr. Mike.
I didn't want to say his name directly, but I'm glad you did because I was thinking of Dr. Mike.
We're sorry for everything we're going to do to science in this episode.
He's too nice to yell at us, though.
And we love him for it.
And now he's held to that. Basically, the electricity will just jump out.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, especially if it contacts the wood, which is a mild conductor, not really, but yeah, especially the wet wood, the electricity just kind of dissipates and it won't go on its way down the wire to its destination.
Oh.
So the insulators keep the wires from touching anything that'll literally suck the electricity out.
So the wood is kind of like an electricity vampire.
It's like an incredibly anemic electricity vampire that gets really powered up when it's wet.
I see. I feel like that's been an anime.
I hope it has. That's 100% an anime I would watch. I did read a couple of interesting things that I was having trouble parsing about how, like, another part of insulators on wires is that you have to keep them a certain distance apart, or the lightning will actually... Lightning. Yeah. So that should give you an insight into how I think about electricity.
Hey, you know what? Lightning is electricity, so,
Yeah, but when I swap them out for each other like that, it makes me sound like a 13th century peasant. The lightning jumps from the magic wires. Like, if they're close enough, the electricity can actually arc from one wire to the next. So, like, part of it is spacing, too, which I thought was interesting.
Oh.
And I can make this practical to the conversation. That does affect the kind of shapes and sizes that you get certain insulators in.
Oh.
According to Webster... Insulate means to separate or cover with a non-conducting material in order to prevent the passage or leakage of electricity, heat, or sound. Communication and electric line wires in service must be kept as dry as possible in order to function efficiently and cut down on loss of current. Oh, my God, I forgot I had a thing here that explained it.
The end.
The wires are kept off the ground by being strung between poles, but something is needed to keep the wires and wet poles apart. This something had to meet three basic needs. It must be made of a fast-drying, non-conducting material. It must be able to hold the line wire in place. It must stay on the pole. This something was the insulator. Commonly made of glass or porcelain, with wire grooves to accommodate the line wire, and a pinhole which fits onto a pin, which in turn is attached to the crossarm of the pole.
Right on.
And I would like to thank insulators.info for that passage. Insulators are actually, they predate lots of things. So there's that. Did you know that if you pick something, it predates lots of things?
I guess technically I didn't know that.
Well, you know, when you think about it, yeah, everything's older than everything that comes after it. So it's like, whoa.
Are you saying that the stones used to build the pyramids are older than the pyramids themselves?
That's exactly what I'm saying, and it's like blow, you know, to the mind. What I'm trying to say is that you actually start first seeing insulators on lightning rods, because that is pretty much, in a pre-electricity world, that is the pretty much the only time you need to be grounding electricity away from something. And that did directly lead to using glass as an insulator for when we needed to supply power over long distances.
With you so far.
Officially, so you see these pop up in 1845 after the invention and popularization of the telegraph. In 1845, they started establishing long lines of telegraph wires across countries. Counties, I meant to say counties. Cross countries. They did that too, I guess.
I mean, there was that whole transatlantic cable.
That's true. I bet they have insulators on that.
Probably. It's very wet under the sea, so I'm told.
It's extremely wet, is the one thing I do know about it. I may not know much.
It's the only thing I know about it, but boy howdy do I know it.
Do I know it? I say it with confidence. So the need for insulators kind of picked up as these technologies became more robust. For example, as telegraphs became more popular and they started crossing more areas and needing to carry larger amounts of current. And then, slowly but surely, electricity is introduced over the exact same kind of pole wire system. And then the telephone is invented, which needs communication wires to be stretched over, again, large tracts of land. You really see the heyday of this in 1936. President Roosevelt passed the Rural Electrification Act, which provided funding for electricity and telephone wiring to be run to rural areas, farms, homesteads, so on and so forth. And this really, really bumped up the amount of insulators that needed to be made. That being said, I don't know what else I could give you for the history of the insulator.
You've done enough, friend. You've done enough.
Shut the podcast down. I'm done. No. One of the really interesting things about insulators are the breadth of time that they were used for and their sheer utilitarian use results in a lot of uniqueness. Like large insulator clubs, consider there to be over 9,000 distinct insulator styles.
Sorry, did you say insulator clubs?
Yeah, I'll get into that. They exist.
All right.
You missed the chance to make the Dragon Ball Z joke.
I'm sorry, I don't watch anime.
You know the over 9,000 meme? God, we're old.
Oh, that one.
Says over 9,000 distinct insulators.
An antique meme, if I do say so myself.
Yeah, well, hey, here at Antiques Freaks, we give you the authentic experience in every way. This is largely because pretty much every time there was a new situation encountered, you needed to have a new insulator just for it. For example, there are parts of the country that experience an awful lot of fog and mist, and special insulators had to be made that had drip skirts that would draw the water away from the wire.
Oh.
And that is one tiny example in a vast sea of, like, need-based development. This was more of a craft than a science for a really long time, so you get a lot of, patent ideas that never really made it to being used that are just crazy. One person pointed out a very bizarre dodecahedron insulator that was manufactured very small numbers, where the idea was that the flat...
Yes! Yes to this!
I knew you'd like that. You're trying to roll it for initiative right now.
I mean, technically that would be a 12-sided die, so it'd only be useful if I were a barbarian, but...
Well, from his own mouth, friends, the nerd that he is.
Shock of shocks, your antiques podcast is run by nerds.
I knew you were not expecting it. You were thinking of us as cool jocks. Basically, in a time where industry moved faster than science, it was just like, well, the flat planes will reduce, they will increase the insulation and reduce current. Yeah, that makes no sense now that we have a basic education, but, you know. But so you see these really unique pieces that pop up that are just examples of people trying to figure out how to provide insulation.
I see.
So nobody really knows who invented the proper insulator. It's frequently attributed in more of like an urban legend kind of way to Ezra Cornell, an employee of Morse, who of course invented Morse code and was involved in the telegraph. They claim he got the idea from looking at glass drawer pulls and thinking, wow, the design of this glass drawer pull is phenomenal.
Listen, can relate. Have done that. Have whiled away many an afternoon staring at glass drawer pulls and just thinking to myself, Man, exquisite.
I can't tell if you're being sarcastic, because it just...
I'm not. They're goddamned effervescent.
I said all that, and then I was like, I'm really being really sarcastic on a podcast that's made exclusively for the sort of people for which that is not an exaggeration.
Yeah.
So, you know, no telling if that's true. The earliest insulators were called drawer pull insulators, but there's really not a lot of information on whether or not that predates or follows the establishment of this sort of legend.
No way of knowing.
Insulators can be grouped into some rough basic groups, although, again, when you say words like over 9,000, you have to understand that the diversity makes it difficult. Insulators are primarily made from glass, later from porcelain, and there's a third category of non-glass, non-porcelain, which is anything. Polished wood, rubber, plastic. Some rural areas were known to have insulators made from animal bone.
Nice.
Very goth. I love the aesthetic.
Extremely good.
Most clubs define place of origin as either North American, including Canada and Mexico, or foreign.
There are two kinds of people.
North American and foreign. They can be classed by their number of parts, of which there's usually only two, either a unipart, a one-piece insulator, by far the most common, or the multipart, an insulator of two or more separately molded parts, either cemented together during or after manufacture, or used together on the line.
All right.
And you could class them by threading characteristics. Did you think I was done? Sorry.
Never.
Threaded, which is an insulator with internal screw threads, which corresponds to matching threads on the pin that they hang on. Very common. Threadless. An insulator without threads, and having a smooth pinhole. Less common. There are also non-pin type insulators, which include spools, dead-end insulators, and wire strain insulators.
Okay.
They come in a vast variety of colors. In the hobby, most everything not clear or aqua-colored is considered a colorful glass. And this was for two reasons. Very rarely, it was to mark an insulator to mark different wires and different poles from each other visually for the linemen. Or, more likely, people who were making insulators were mostly glass houses that were making all sorts of things out of glass and made the insulators from cullet, which are chunks of glass that are recycled.
Kind of like jadeite.
A lot like jadeite. So you get just a ton of colors because they crammed whatever was in the leftover bins and made some insulators to sell later.
Nice.
There are some exceptions, but there aren't that many, so I won't talk about them. No one cares. No, sorry.
Wow.
That was mean.
I'm just picturing the one person who tuned in specifically for the exceptions just dejectedly turning their phone off.
Well, listen here. No, wait. Oh, God, don't turn your phone off. For example, the Hemingray insulator. Hemingray was a glass company that, while they didn't just make insulators, really spearheaded the production of insulators. And most of the insulators you'll find in the wild will be Hemingray. And you'll know because they have the word Hemingray stamped on most of them.
Uh-huh.
Now, usually they're not stamped because there was no reason to differentiate them from each other. Sometimes certain manufacturers would stamp style numbers just for their own cataloging purposes. And even more rarely, a production company would stamp like a type of insulator, just kind of a number that corresponds with sort of the kind that they make. Here are three types of insulators I found that made me laugh very hard. The three Rumple.
Starting strong.
The teardrop pony and the teat rest, not to be confused with the teat.
Amazing.
I know, listen, I know that when you're talking historical design, a teat actually refers to like any like bump in a design, but it's still really funny.
The reason they're called that is because that bump in the design reminds people of certain bumps in certain other designs.
That's true.
Some would say intelligent designs.
Ooh, you get it? My God. Wow, you're just going to come out and say that on our podcast.
No.
I know, this is all for jokes and funs. So we actually see the shift over to porcelain insulators starting around the 1950s and increasing completely by the 1970s. And actually, there are still some porcelain or ceramic insulators used now because they're just the more efficient option. The transition to porcelain was made mostly because by the 1950s, the electricity and telecom needs of the country, of the North America, I guess, if we're going to get granular the way the clubs do, was just requiring massive amounts of power to be transmitted, which means you needed a really, really heavy-duty insulator. And glass, at that point, was just not up to the job.
Damn it, glass.
I know, glass, you look...
This is your last warning.
You look so good, glass. As a result of a complete transition over to porcelain, and the, you know, constant ongoing maintenance of these power lines, a lot of the glass insulators just got, and I'm not kidding here, collected and thrown in holes.
Just, you're just gonna get them all together in a pile and toss them in a pit?
And they only did that because it was considered rude to just throw them on the goddamn ground.
They went full Atari's ET with it?
They did. Yeah, so when they changed out insulators or took down poles and installed new ones, a lot of times the companies would just bring them back and throw them in a goddamn ditch.
Wow.
So this is a small part of the grand tapestry of glass digging. Because weirdly, getting rid of excess glass, a very common method was to dig a hole and throw it in there.
Like you do.
So a lot of times when you're looking to pioneer, you know, your insulator collection, there are a lot of people out there who actually research like maps and blueprints and stuff to find old pole placements that aren't on private property, of course. Wink, wink.
Deep.
And they will dig sometimes for years around the areas where these poles were placed, trying to find like a dump zone.
Oh my god, it's a treasure hunt.
It is a genuine treasure hunt. I think your reaction is exactly why people get so into it.
Amazing.
You go on an adventure to your local library or city hall, you get the information, and you painstakingly chase down your treasure.
I love it. I'm on board.
It's really cool. One of my favorite things to do in antiques is to just listen to glass hounds tell stories about how they've uncovered caches and stuff.
Yes.
It's so cool. A lot of the earliest insulator collectors were actually just the linesmen who were working the poles. Since nobody cared about what happened to the insulators, the people working the power lines often just bring them home. And, you know, there was a lot of people who worked on the power lines over the years, you know, over the last 200 years, it turns out.
a few.
This kind of influenced, like, an interesting culture of, like, collecting and trading these, what were for a very long time considered completely worthless. I mean, that shifted real fast from, like, worthless to, there are insulators now that are worth over, you know, several hundred dollars. That is unusual, granted, but, and there is a very organized, very intentional collecting culture around insulators. I was unprepared and extremely impressed with what I found. There is actually a formalized system for identifying them called the CD system, based on a variety of design elements. And this is done entirely by collectors, by the way. Based on design elements, the insulator will be assigned a CD number that will help you look it up in a reference guide or talk to other collectors about it. So, you know, instead of saying, well, it's got this shape, that shape, the other shape, it's got little bibbits at the end, you can actually just buy, like, a $20 guide and say, it's a CD-102. And then either they'll know it, which is unlikely, there's a lot of them, or they'll just also look in their guide and find the corresponding item.
Very cool.
Looking at it is the most insane thing. The amount of taxonomic work that goes into this is impressive in a way I have trouble, like, conveying.
No, I believe it.
And, you know, I think that's just another facet of what makes these collectible and interesting. Like, if you're that kind of person, you know, if you get excited about the Dewey Decimal System and all that, and you're really into, like, taxonomic, like, determining, this can be, like, a really fun way to just exercise that interest. That being said, these are extremely numerous. Part of why I had sort of thrown insulators by the wayside, so to speak, was because growing up in an antiques household, if we might call it that, these things were, like, the background noise of my life.
Every time you turn a corner, you're tripping over a pile of insulators.
Yeah, I don't know if this is maybe a regional thing, too. They were so common. Up until pretty recently, it was very easy to find boxes of them for just like a dollar.
Damn.
So I never really gave them any second thought. I thought it was like cup plates where all I knew about them is that people used them for yard art and put them in their windows to sparkle, and that was it. I mean, I knew what they were and where they came from because I knew glass people. But I just never dedicated any thought, and like finding out how much love and hard work goes into the collection is really cool. And even cooler given that, like I said, these are so numerous that getting started is really cheap and really easy.
All right.
Some tips on repairs. So obviously, since these are utility objects, they are very frequently broken, chipped, cracked. Interestingly enough, while the condition will end up influencing the price, it's not a deal breaker in any insulators. And two things I found really interesting that I, for some reason, had never considered. UV curing resin for repairing completely broken pieces.
Oh!
It's clear. It bonds very strong and immediately and with no extra solvent than just the sun.
That's awesome.
The modern UV resins don't even yellow, so. And for cleaning, other than just soap and water, a lot of glass cleaners will tell you about tumbling. Chris Childress of insulators.info says, "It is my belief that collectors should always try hand cleaning an insulator before submitting it to the tumbling process."
Okay.
The tumbling process I'm familiar with is either sand or, like, copper pellets that are gently shaken back and forth for a period of time. It very slowly and very gently strips off the outer layer of the glass. A lot of people use this to treat, like, permanently ruined sick glass. It is a little on the extreme side, and he suggests oxalic acid. You can also use sodium hydroxide, also known as lye. Lye can be really dangerous to work with. I like the idea of oxalic acid because it's just kind of like turbo vinegar. It's still kind of dangerous to be working with, but it's not an immediate touch, burn your flesh kind of situation. I'd say it's a really accessible acid for hobbyist cleaning. This doesn't fit anywhere else, but while I was going on this, like, reading spree, insulator people don't like antiques dealers.
No?
Every guide to collecting that I found said to forego and distrust the antiques market because of their predatory behavior and markups.
Wow.
Which I can't argue with. And... And Mr. Childress of insulators.info also says, "Many areas of antiques and collectibles are cold and businesslike. Although you won't find nicer people in any other hobby than insulator collecting." And honestly, I believe it.
What?
So, that's a rough covering of insulators and collecting them. There aren't many fakes. The only thing that you really have to look out for fakes is artificially colored, which, as we've covered many times talking about glass, artificial purpling through microwave is extremely common. You see that a lot on eBay. Like I said, if you're serious about collecting insulators or even just interested in collecting insulators, there are a lot of resources, so you can kind of look up what colors are possible or ever seen in insulators, and you can just kind of compare that.
All right.
As for sources, I have insulators.info. Have to have one every time. I gotta say, this is 100% your one-stop shop for information. They have full CD listing guides, pictures, links to extremely scholarly articles about the niche histories of sub-businesses working off of sub-businesses making insulators. So please check that out if you're interested. This is also collectorsweekly.com, insulators, collectorsweekly.com, interview with glass insulator collector Ian Mackey, glassbottlemarks.com, general overview of glass insulators, and antiques.lovetoknow.com, antique glass insulators, as well as Wikipedia.
If you would like to tell us more about this insurmountable rift that has arisen between the insulator and antiquing communities, you can email us directly at antiquesfreakspodcast@gmail.com, or join our Facebook group, Antiques Freaks Friends, or check out our Tumblr at antiquesfreaks.tumblr.com.
If you like the words we put into your ears today, consider scrolling down to wherever you're listening to this podcast and leaving us a review, any kind of review. I like the 5-star ones. Ken, he insists that any is good. I'm just going to remind you about how happy the 5-star ones make me. No judgment, but whatever you want.
And if you would like to listen to deleted scenes, you can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/antiquesfreaks. Where you can donate to help support the podcast, pay for our hosting fees, and get us ever closer to our goal of releasing bonus episodes. Something happened to my front teeth there, S's sound like now.
I was going to let it stand. Just leave it in.
Throw it in.
Do a live.
Special shout out to our current patrons for helping us out and filling our hearts with love.
So much love.
And thank you in particular for listening.
That's right, you.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.